and welcome to another Round the Rotary with me, your host, JP Warren. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And before we begin, I got to say that Round the Rotary podcast is brought to you by Capital Petroleum Consultants. CPC specializes in project engineering and well site supervision in all disciplines of the oil and gas industry. Contact us through www.capitalpetroleumconsultants.com to see what CPC can do for you today. But today, we're not talking about oil and gas. We are talking about a different black gold. Black, is there another term for it besides?
I consider it black gold.
Black gold, black water, whatever you want to call it. Whatever you
want to call it. Gold sounds better.
Gold does sound a little bit better. But hey, anyway, today, everyone, we got an interesting episode today. We have J.D. Smith, which is the founder of Cuevas Coffee Roasters. Did I get that Cuevas correct?
Yeah,
I did. So J.D. has an interesting story, actually. And this is a fourth generation oil and gas person who found himself pursuing a different passion, kind of, I guess, when shit hit the fan with the pandemic, the COVID, the quarantine lockdown. You decided, rather than just sit there and wait for things to turn around, you kind of took the bull by the horns and kind of pursued your passion, which is, and what we talked about before, that's kind of something that people always bring up on this podcast, that you said, it's like, do what you love. Pursue what you love, pursue your passion. And as we said, that's easy to do, you know, if you're collecting a paycheck. But for those, I think it's just a cool story. And I'm interested to talk to you and learn more about kind of your background and kind of what brought you into the coffee industry and learn more a little bit about coffee. Because I'm a coffee drinker.
Yeah,
I am. And I'm assuming you are too. You have to be.
Yeah, pretty good.
I don't think you're a coffee drinker, though. From what you were saying before, it sounds like you're a coffee sommelier.
Coffee connoisseur, I guess.
Coffee connoisseur, I'll take that. So, JD, kick us off, man. Why don't you give us a little background and kind of bring us up to speed on kind of where you're at today. And then let's get into the kind of the business and kind of the goals and where you're going and kind of your ideas on your brand.
Yeah, so appreciate having me in today, JP. Well,
thanks for making the trip to come in, buddy.
Yeah, first time here at the office. Really good.
First podcast, too.
Yeah,
huh?
First podcast. So.
Dude, every time I do a podcast, it feels like a first time. But hold on a second. I'm going to pause you real quick because I'm about to. So, what we're doing right now, if those that aren't watching us on YouTube right now, JD came in from Dallas.
Yes.
Dallas and brought us some of his coffee. He brought us some freshly ground coffee. And we just brewed that. We're about to sip on it. I'm about to try my first sip, so stand by. Which one is this?
This is the Tanzania.
This is the Tanzania. Okay. I'm going to get close to the mic so people can be here with us. That's good. That's smooth.
You can tell you're a coffee guy.
That's good.
Because they say the louder you slurp, the better off it is for the taste.
Really?
Because it actually gets the taste to the surface of the coffee, and you can taste the different flavor profiles.
That's literally why I just did that.
Yeah.
It wasn't to joke around. It wasn't for for laughs. I mean, that's why I did that. So
yeah. So many people don't know that green coffee, the raw product, has about 50 sensory mechanisms in it.
What do you
mean? So there's 50 different tastes profiles.
Really?
In green coffee, when you roast it, it turns to 250 plus flavor profiles.
Okay.
So what you're tasting there is actually the soil that's grown in, the terroir that that the farm is in, and also just the different aspects of the coffee, right? So if you taste kind of some, you know, fruity aspects of it, or some flowery, or some, you know, more earthy tones, depends on where it's grown. There's, you know, four different regions in the world where coffee is grown: Central America, South America. You have Africa and Asia, Java coffee, and then you have some Hawaiian coffee.
Right.
There's actually not a single coffee farm in the continental U.S.
Okay.
People don't know that.
Well, let's hold on. Slow down. You're learning me up a little too quick. Let's get your background first, and I'll kind of want to get into the coffee pro. So this is – the coffee right now, it's strong, but it's smooth.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like that's how my wife would describe me. Strong, smooth, and lazy, but this is not lazy. This will keep you up.
So. Oh, yeah, for sure.
So go on. So where are you from and where are you at today?
Yeah, a little background is, like you said, I'm fourth generation oil field. Grew up oil and gas. My father, always on the drilling side.
Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up all over the world. I was born in Oklahoma, Shawnee.
Okay.
Spent 6 years of my life there, moved to Dallas.
All right.
My dad worked for Santa Fe Minerals.
Okay, yeah.
And he was there until they sold out. And then he decided to go back international. He'd worked international before. From Dallas, and moved to Indonesia.
Okay.
We were in Jakarta for for a year and a half.
And were you with him at the time?
Yes, we moved as expats over there.
Okay.
So he worked for InSearch, which was a consulting firm that offered services to Mandela Nusantara, which was the president's son's company of Indonesia. Was there until 1998 and then moved to Tulsa.
So how old were you when you moved out of there?
In Jakarta?
Yes.
10.
10, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Moved to Tulsa. That's where the home office for Vintage Petroleum was located at.
Okay.
And then moved to Bolivia, which is where my ties to Bolivia come from, where it's where the coffee's from, or right. where our farm is.
Right.
Was there 3.5 years. My dad worked for Occidental, okay. which was Vintage Petroleum at the time, and then Oxy had bought them.
Okay.
My mother-in-law now was his co-worker at Vintage Petroleum. So that's the ties to my wife. We've known each other since we were 10.
Keep it in the circles.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Moved to Trinidad and Tobago.
All right.
Was there about a year and then moved to Kingston, Oklahoma, which is where I graduated high school from.
Okay.
I actually graduated high school from Ardmore, a town called Plainview.
All right.
Yeah.
I've only been to Oklahoma one time. It was with my buddy Jake Voss. He just brought me over the line. He's like, okay, you're in Oklahoma, turned around. So I haven't spent much time up there, but my in-laws are from there.
Okay.
That area.
So, what part? Yeah.
Puxahatchee, something like that. I don't know. I'm a good listener. So as you can tell. So how was that growing up all over, I guess, having that international experience? How was that growing up as a kid until you kind of went to high school in Oklahoma?
You know, it's kind of like love or hate, right? I mean, I have a lot of friends that went to the same school for 12 years, yeah. and they have, you know, they're tight-knit of friends. So I just kind of compare it to this. I did the numbers one time, like 11 schools growing up, right?
That's so tough, man.
Yeah, you're moving a lot.
Yeah.
Meeting new friends, but I'm an extrovert, so I like meeting people, right?
So it was easy for you to kind of blend in?
Yeah, so I just kind of figure, you know, 11 schools, that means I have 11 group of friends.
That's
and
cool,
I okay. still can, I still keep in contact with my oldest friend and then the latest friend that I'd last met in high school, right?
Right.
And then, of course, college and on, so. Right?
Cool.
So, graduated high school. I always wanted to be a doctor.
All right.
I didn't tell you this before, but I've had 2 heart surgeries. I was born with a heart defect.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So I always wanted to be a cardiologist or an anesthesiologist.
And so does coffee kind of marriage into a heart defect situation where it's...
They say it can actually take, you know, if you have like a heart murmur or something, it could actually, you know, make that better.
Really?
Yeah, because it gets your rhythm.
Okay.
Born
check. Okay. All right.
I'm not a doctor, so I recommend that.
Yeah. Anyone listening, if you're taking medical advice from around the rotary, please don't.
Yeah.
Go
and
see
a,
someone.
And a coffee owner.
And a coffee owner. Yeah. Let's find someone else. So,
yeah.
So you want to be a doctor?
Yeah. Started off, you know, in I was a chemistry major.
Okay.
And I have a minor in it. I claim that, but don't use it too much.
Well, were you interested in chemistry? I mean,
yeah, I loved chemistry and I loved math and science growing up. Almost went to Oklahoma School of Science and Math, which is a pretty elite school that you don't have to get, you know, accepted to go there. Didn't have sports, didn't have, you know, much social life, so decided not to do that.
They had mathletes.
Yeah, so I took the ACT when I was in 8th grade and scored a perfect score in math and science. The two I didn't score very well, one was English and reading, and it's sad because my mom was an English major. And it broke her heart. You know, I had a 10 in English and a 10, or 10 in reading and a 12 in English and a 36 in math and science. So
we know where you got those genes from.
Yeah,
which side of the family? Which side? I mean,
from my dad's
side. English. Yeah, I'm over there. That was the only Q drop I did at Texas A&M was a technical write. It was an English course. I'm like, I get it. Anyway.
Yeah. So you know, I went to. First started college in Dallas at a community college. My dad was living there, cheap tuition, you know, we'll kick it off there. And then spent a semester there and then moved up to OU, where my wife, we were dating at the time, was already going to OU.
Okay, okay.
She did accounting there. So get up to OU and, you know, I was, you know, a chemistry major. I wanted to do pre-med and, okay, but the fallback plan for most doctors, you know, is a dentist, right? My dad's cousin's a dentist. So I said, that summer – I'll go and spend time with him, and I'll work with him for a month.
Right.
And my wife was like, you got too fat of fingers to be working in someone's mouth. So I go there, and I'm like, no, that's not for me.
Right.
You know, I'm there at a dentist office all day long. He's making crowns and showing me all this stuff. It's like, it doesn't interest me.
Not your thing.
And I always wanted to be in the oil and gas industry. But my dad, you talked about another podcast. He lived through, you know, he's worked through the 80s,
yeah,
the crash in the, yeah, 80s, you know. So he's seen a lot of ups and downs. And he told me it's always a roller coaster, right? And he said, you don't want to go in the oil and gas industry. No, no, no. You don't want to do that. I was a pumper in high school, actually.
Oh, okay.
Back a little bit. Was a pumper for 2 years.
So you had a little bit of experience.
Yeah, and I actually hid that from my dad because I knew he wouldn't be happy with it, right?
Okay.
And in the end, he was like, no, I would have, you know, I would definitely been an advocate for you, and a, you know, supporter. But finally, I, you know, that summer, I said, hey, Dad, look, I want to go in the oil and gas industry. Okay. Well, what's holding you back? I said, well, you've always told me never to go into the oil and gas industry. He said, well, if you be an engineer, you know, that's one thing he didn't do was get an engineering degree. He said, if you become an engineer, then it's probably better off.
Okay.
He did Hard Knocks.
Right.
Started off as a roustabout when he was 14 or 15.
Got the knowledge from the field level. Right, right.
He's done it all, right? So I said, okay, well, what do I do? Mechanical or chemical engineering? It kind of, chemical made sense because I was a chemistry major. But then I was like, petroleum engineering because I know I want to go in the oil and gas.
Right.
I don't want to be working for, you know, Boeing or anything with a mechanical engineering degree.
Right.
So started with petroleum engineering. Took intro to petroleum engineering. My buddy Nick was on the podcast and called out Dr. Sam.
Yep. Yeah.
And
yeah.
He actually inspired me to be a great engineer.
So you went from pursuing to be a doctor, and then finally after, I guess, a little internship or a stint or whatever you want to call it in a dental office, you're like, I'm good. I want to pursue that kind of, I guess, gave you a taste for that lifestyle, and you decided to pursue petroleum engineer.
You know, growing up, I grew up on rigs.
Yeah.
Like the biggest part of my week was waiting for Friday because I knew my dad would take me to the field.
Okay.
And I would go there. Back then, you could slide down the slide.
Oh.
And I'd slide the slide and always on the floor. There was a little bit too much cussing in the field at the time, so my mom didn't really like it.
But, right.
You know, I loved the field.
Right.
And I thought that was what the oil field was all about. I didn't know there was an office. You know,
yeah.
I was like, no, it's the rig, right?
Yeah.
What do you mean there's an office? You know, I know you work in an office, but, oh, there's accountants there? It's not only just drillers?
Yeah.
So I being in an office environment or, you know, a dental office all day long, it just turned me off.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I don't want to be outside.
Yeah, you didn't grow up around that. I mean, if you had fun going to location as a kid, you know, you view that as a big playground. I mean, yeah, and you get stuck in an office with a, you know, white coat and all that. Yeah, I can understand the appeal.
And you know, I just graduated college, you know, or sorry, just graduated high school before this, you know, a year later, you know, working at a dental office. And back then I was a pumper, you know, started off as a pumper. I was working workover rigs. Whenever the workover rig was there, they paid me. I got $10 an hour as a pumper.
All right.
And I got $15 when the workover rig was there.
Okay.
So Anthony, I work with Cantrell Energy.
Okay.
Which I think they're still around, Ada, Oklahoma. So they said, when they have the workover rigs here, you know, we'll take you on, right? But I was just like the lowest. I was the worm.
Yeah.
You know, grab this, grab that. I was 16, 17 years old. You know, so, you know, going from that and, you know, I worked the floor and then finally worked Derek's at the very end. And, the rig operator told me, look, you know, Anthony didn't show up for work today. So you're going to work the board. I said, I've never been up there. He said, I'm going to ride the elevators up. You're going to watch me. And you're going to ride them up too. I'm going to latch back two stands here, which stands two, you know, pieces of tubing.
Right.
And then you're going to get it done. If you can't get it done, you're going to be a bitch pumper like you always were. Which that's a bad word to use, but I mean,
you know what?
That's what he told me.
He rode the elevators up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
That's how it was.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't do that anymore.
No. I mean,
nowadays you don't do that. But
no.
Back then it was like that.
No, I've worked the derricks on the Noble Lord's booze guard for a you know, hitch or two, and tower or two, whatever. And it's like, yeah, you had to walk. I can't imagine like taking the elevators up. I'd shit myself.
Yeah,
yeah.
And, you know, when you're first up on the board, they just run the blocks up so quick, trying to
mess with you,
trying to get you to miss. And I threw a couple across. I mean, I laid a couple across. I mean, I'm brand new up there, right? I'm 17 years old. Like,
right.
These guys are just messing with me, right? But you know, it taught me a lot. It taught me about you know. It's sink or swim, right? And they gave me that option. It's like, you want to make $15 an hour and you think you're going to make good money, you're still in high school, look, sink or swim.
Yeah.
You get it or not.
And okay.
I got it. And then they were like, yeah, we want JD on the rig. You know, so I built a good relationship with them. And
you got in that little circle.
I like that.
Yeah, okay.
So then I go to college and it's like, oh, I'm going to be a powder puff doctor, dentist, you know. It's going to be good money, but is it going to be worth it, right? Am I going to do what I love?
Yeah.
So changed to petroleum engineering.
Did you like the classes? I mean, did you enjoy petroleum engineering?
Oh, I loved it.
Okay.
Every single course. I still talk to my professors today, my old professors.
Professor
like
Sam?
Dr. Akutlu, Dr. Sam. I haven't seen Sam in a while. Me and his son were in the same class.
Okay.
So I still keep up with Michael. You know, Carl Sondergeld is a very well-known geophysicist in the industry, and a few others, right? So,
yeah.
You know, just loved it, right?
Well,
you know, Dr. Sam said, okay, you know, internships. I don't know what internship is. You know, I'd never heard of that before, right? Like internship. Yeah, it's where you take a, you know, you're training in the oil field and somebody's going to pick you up and they're going to give you a intro level job, you know, working a summer.
Pretty much what you've been doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, what to do? You know, he said there's career fair and it was kind of late. I didn't have a resume at the time. You know, I'm brand new. I'm, you know, 18 years old, like, okay, how do I do a resume? I go to career services. They set me all up. And I just said, okay, there's 40 people to interview, and I'm going to sign up for 40 people. So I interviewed 23 companies and got 21 offers.
Wow.
And I didn't even know. And the offer I got that I accepted, I thought it was a bad interview.
Really? So would you attribute that to, I guess, getting out into the field and getting that firsthand experience and not sitting around and taking a cushy summer job, you know, lifeguarding in college? You actually went to the field. Would you attribute, I guess, your success, I guess, in the interview process to getting out, get some real world experience?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've just always worked since I've been 15. You know, I always, you know, liked working and always just kind of put myself around older people, right?
Right.
You know, I'd worked at a golf course in high school. I was a pumper as well, you know, and always was around people that were 10 years older than me. And, you know, I call them this. I mean, it was my dad's good friends. Yeah. You know, it's kind of changing now, the industry, but used to, you know, a group of guys stayed together forever, right? And my dad had four really good friends that were always with him.
Yeah.
And they were like my uncles. Like, I called them uncles.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, two passed away in the last year. But these guys taught me a lot, right? So. But they weren't easy on me, right? They're always joking with me.
Oh, they're messing with you. Yeah.
Go get the key to the V door. Never fail for that. My dad always told me, but I was probably, you know, 15 years old.
The Skyhook and the air quality samples.
So I was, you know, trained by a good group of people, right? And it just kind of taught me how to talk to people and how to present myself.
But I guess what I was asking that, I think some people that are listening right now, because we just did one with the Texas A&M SP, Dean Murphy and Keaton Upshaw. And we're going to be doing another one. It'll be released by the time this is released. But it's that experience that I'm talking about. And for people that, you talk to people. In the industry, and so what can people do to kind of prep for themselves? But just as that, it's number one, it's getting out there and working. And the second thing, what you brought up, is the mentorship aspect of it and asking for mentorship and surrounding yourself with people that know more than you. And I just think that's the value you get from that and just what you spoke to, I think is tremendous.
Yeah, I mean, one of my mentors growing up and still to this day, he always told me this, is in a group of 10 people, you want to be in the bottom five.
Go on.
You want to
explain that.
You want to be in the bottom five of that 10 people.
Why?
Because you don't want to be the best guy in the room. You're not learning anything from that. You're not taking anything away. So you want to be in the bottom five so you can gain the most from the conversation. If you're the worst guy in the room, not the worst, but the least experienced guy in the room, you actually have the most to gain from that table.
Okay.
And the most to take away.
That's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah. And it was actually my principal, Mr. Parham, in high school that taught me that. He said, you know, because I was hanging around some guys, you know, getting troubles.
Like, yeah.
Look, you want to be in the bottom five of your group. So hang out with people that are better than you, right? Not better, but more experienced.
Yeah.
Older, maybe.
You can learn stuff from.
They may be older. They may not. They may have better experiences than you do or a title or, you know, different things and aspects of life. So
yeah.
I think that's a key thing, too. But definitely, you know, working in the field, it trains you to talk, you know, to people openly, right?
Well, that's what, I mean, I've said this before. I mean, I remember when I was at Noble, I mean, I started off in HSC and I'd be so nervous to call the rig, you know, because I didn't know the operations. I didn't know what went out there. I didn't know how to talk to these people, you know what I mean? To the people on the rig. And once I started working out there and people are like, you know, what's the best thing you took away from that? Was it the operation knowledge? Was it the experience? The best thing I took away was that I can banter with these people. These are my friends now. Like you can talk to anyone from the CEO down to the roustabout, and it's and you know how to talk to them. So I think the ability to communicate and engage is also important, you know, and that's just it doesn't come in school. You know, it comes with meeting people and talking and working. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think, you know, working as many jobs as you can growing up and just having those experiences, right? Because when I interviewed and I took a job, it was in between Chevron and Marathon.
Okay.
Marathon was kind of weird because it was a HR representative in the room with an engineer, Jude Nwosu and Lisa Ortega.
Okay.
Those two people. I still remember to this
tell.
Day.
I can tell.
And I can't tell you the people in the other interviews, but I remember those two because I still talk to Jude today.
All right.
And, you know, at the time I was working for, it's Torex Drill Bits now. Now it was Jay-Z Bits before.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's good friend has owned that business, you know, family business forever, and then they sold out to Torex. But so I was working there about 50 hours a week in their shop, and then I ran a batting cage for them.
Okay.
For the owner, Israel Waitman. So, you know, that was on my resume, and they asked me, you know, what do you do in your free time? I said, what free time? And they're like, well, you know, when you're not in school. I said, I work 50 hours a week. And they were like, you work 50 hours a week and you have a 3.6 GPA? They're like, okay, well, we're interested. Come to dinner with us tonight. So I was like, okay.
All right.
You know, and then they offered me a job, and I went to work for Marathon.
Okay.
So then it goes to my first internship. He was in Midland, Texas, worked for Randy Bowes and Tom Brininger out there.
And what were you doing?
And I was a production engineering intern.
Okay, gotcha.
So since they – and I always thought when I go in the oil field, I'm going to go straight to drilling.
Right.
You know, because that was what my dad did, right?
Well, and that's what you knew. I mean, that's the only thing you knew. Yeah.
So I go out there and working in, you know, this was 2008, right? Blowing and going, you know, oil's 100 and something, you know, so very good. I was doing P&As on some older wells.
Okay.
And then I was abandoning the bottom half of some wells and then recompleting up, you know.
Okay.
In a better zone.
Right.
In, you know, potential areas. So we did small mini fracs and stuff like that. I learned a lot. I digitized well files. I thought it was a, you know, a bad job. You know, I just thought it was busy work at the time, but I learned a lot.
Yeah.
Because you work, you know, some of these wells from 1927, 1930. So we had the Santa Rita number one on our lease, which is a discovery well of West Texas, right? In Big Lake.
Yeah.
And, you know, digitizing those well files and putting them on actually, you know, on the computer.
I think that's fascinating.
And I had, you know, the well file maybe that big for one well.
Yeah.
And you're trying to update the wellbore schematic. And I would use, at that time, Excel to do my wellbore schematics. And I just digitized all the well files. And then I like working so much, and I wanted to learn that. And I got paid hourly, so that helped.
Yeah.
But then Randy finally told me, hey, JD, you know, we don't pay 24 hours a day. Because I'd be there till like 8 o'clock at night. And he's like, look, we can only pay you 8 hours a day, not 24. I said, it doesn't matter. I'll work and not get paid for the overtime because I'm learning so much right now. And then finally just worked up the, you know, the trust with Randy that he would send me out on job myself.
Okay.
And I would go watch a cement unit pump cement on wells. You know, we'd plug 12 a week.
Okay.
We just go plug, 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 plug. And then we'd have a well every 2 weeks that we'd say, okay, we're going to do a mini frack on this. So JD, go plug the bottom half, set a plug, and then we're going to come in with wireline, shoot some holes and frack it, right?
Okay.
Which, you know, we'd have like 10 trucks on location and, you know, all these frack tanks. And it was probably, I don't know, maybe 20,000 pounds of sand. And I thought it was a massive job.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Now you pump half a million.
Well, your first thing out there, you're seeing this orchestra, this huge dance of everyone thing, all these moving parts, you know, coming together. So I can imagine just kind of being like mind blown and being like, holy shit, this is okay. This is a real deal.
Yeah, so, you know, I had a great, you know, I learned a lot that summer. I met a lot of good friends, still talk to them to this day. And then we have a poster presentation marathon at the end of every internship. And what you do is you create a poster, what you did that summer, and you present it.
Okay.
And Clarence Cazalot, the CEO at the time, would walk around the floor and stop and ask people stuff. Well, you know, I just threw mine together because I was so busy working the field. I was like, I got that intern, you know, presentation. Let me just throw something together.
Right.
So I just threw some stuff together. Randy helped me a little bit, and he listened a lot to Rush Limbaugh.
Okay.
And so he was like, you know, during rush time, you don't mess with Randy. And if he's listening there. But
I'm sure he is.
Yeah, put together this poster, go to Houston. We fly in, and, you know, I'm sitting there and explaining to people because they, you know, engineers and managers are all walking the floor. It's just right. Kind of an open house. I guess it's in August. Well, Clarence stops by. I'm like, I didn't know really who he was. I saw him talk up on stage a couple of times, but he stopped by. I was like,
it doesn't hit you the level of where people are at when
So I didn't do anything different. I just saw him walk up and really didn't recognize him at the time, and I just gave him the same spiel on my presentation, my poster, as I did everybody else. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, you know this guy, oh yeah. And he got into it, and he said at my poster, and some of the interns were like, you're stealing his time. You know, I don't know who he is. He just asked me questions.
I'm trying to steal it.
15 minutes there, right? So it was just learning to talk to people like that really grew me as an individual.
Okay.
And then we get done with that. I go back to school. Marathon, you know, we really like you. We're going to give you another offer, right? So I thought, yeah, it's going to be another field internship or drilling. Man, I'm excited. And then they say reservoir engineering.
Okay.
And I said, okay, what's reservoir? And then talking to my dad on the phone, I'm like, they want me to be a pencil pusher and, you know, nothing bad about reservoir. I wanted to be in the field.
Yeah, I mean, that was your perception. That was your perception back in the day.
And then they offered me, you know, I was the campus ambassador for Marathon for the student union.
Okay.
So I'd give presentations and try to recruit, you know, different students in my class to go work for Marathon.
That's got to be such a cool role, too. I mean, you're connecting the real world with, you know, the students who are about to enter the room. I mean, I think that's just a cool.
And I'd give a little speech. You know, it was me, Josh Teer, which is still at Marathon, I believe. We would – him and then I can't believe – there was two other ambassadors. I can't remember the names, just me and Josh. But we would give our spiel and what we learned and why we chose Marathon and how good of a company it is, right? And then people would, you know, interview with us, et cetera, right? So, you know, I worked throughout the year with them and then kept my job at the bit place in the betting cage. Went to work reservoir for Shaheen Nezhad and Laura Reich.
Okay.
They're both not at Marathon anymore, but Shaheen is ex-Shell. You know, he's from Iran. Very, very knowledgeable in the reservoir engineering game. And he shows up and he says, you know Eclipse? I said, I've never heard of Eclipse. What? Oh, I thought you were a graduate intern. I said, no, I'm an undergrad. What are you talking about? He's like, oh, it's reservoir modeling software. And he's kind of like, oh, man, I thought I had some help here. I said, I'll learn it.
Yeah.
And, you know, just dove into it. And there was a guy named Ron Stoltz. He's still there, a guru at Eclipse, probably one of the best in the industry on the software, right?
All right.
So I was just like, dang, this guy expects the world of me, Shaheen. And, you know, I'm here, don't even know how to use the software. He's just wasted his time, you know?
So the thing is, the mentality, not to interrupt, but the mentality you had was like, that's fine if I don't know. That's fine if you think I'm the wrong person for this role. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm going to learn this regardless.
And I think it goes back to sink or swim.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, on Eclipse. You got to create your whole, you know, software data, you know, log, and you got to build your model. And then you have to run it on the PCUs, which, you know, you're probably not in line to have access to those. So you have to run them overnight. You can't, you know, everybody else. I was working Gulf of Mexico Neptune project. So every other engineer that's running Eclipse had the licenses tied up because there were so many licenses.
Oh, they don't get to put it on. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so you had to put it to a CPU board and it would run all the, you know, all the modeling software.
Okay.
So I had to do mine overnight. Okay. So it was just like I only had work during that day and then I had to send it overnight. And then the next day, if it was bad, I had to wait till the next day. So I'd work 7 days a week.
A lot of trial and errors.
But I learned so much. And I worked with some really good people that taught me so much about reservoir. And they said, look, when you're out there in the production role or in a drilling role or whatever in the future, just remember, this is where oil comes from. This is where it starts.
All right.
And for me, I like instant gratification, which is a few people in your podcast have said instant gratification.
Which drilling. Is why the drilling. Yeah, which is why they're attracted to the drilling side of things.
Yeah, because my model that I did was the M10 reservoir on Neptune Project, which is a layer of sandstone that may be complete in the future, may not, whatever, 10 years down the road. But learned so much. I learned like the background of it, exactly what we're doing in the oil and gas industry. And it kind of brings it full circle. So the next summer, I had new you know, kind of through my dad, a guy named Ray Brewer, which was the drilling superintendent for Marathon, and Jeff Day.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, man, I gotta get in the drilling group next summer. I can't go back to a different place. You know, definitely drilling, right? So Jeff Day came down to talk to me when I was in reservoir and, oh, you know, this guy. And, you know, he knew my dad and everything. He knew the same contacts, and we just kind of hit it off.
Okay.
He's like, I want you to be an intern for me and my group next year. Next summer.
Right.
So I did my third internship in drilling, worked for Pete Langille and Russ Truby.
Oh, yeah.
And then Steve Tucker was my mentor. And I worked I thought I was going to be like a company man right off the bat, right? Oh, yeah, I'm going to be the guy on location, and I'm going to go trip pipe with the guys, which I did that. I worked with a guy named Johnny Cox in East Texas.
Yeah.
And he's still out in East Texas. I think he left Marathon now, but, you know, went out in the rig and set with him.
So was drilling kind of everything that you were hoping for?
Yeah.
When you jumped into it, you're like, okay, this is instant gratification. I'm on the rig. Yeah. This
meets
the ground.
I grew up with all my dad's, you know, best friends being around me all the time. Yeah. They're like my uncles. And I just felt like I was back home.
Okay. Because
when I went out there talking to Johnny and, you know, the guys on location, it's just like, this is where I feel at home, right?
Okay.
Chase Guest was my safety guy. So we played jokes on each other. Eating contest. You know, let's do a 40-yard sprint, see who wins. You know, stuff like that.
Just random stuff.
You feel like a family out there.
Yeah.
And you're there 24/7 for 14 days, right? So I did rotation. And Jeff was like, you know, 14 and 14. I said, well, what am I doing my 14 days off? He said, oh, that's your time to be off. That's rotation. I said, well, why? Where am I going to go?
What am I going to do?
He's like, go home. You spend time with your family. I said, no, I want to go in the office. He said, oh, you can come in the office if you want to. So I would work 14 days in the rig, and I would go to the office for 14 days or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I started this – now it's called Meridrill, but back then it was – I'm trying to think – Drill Right. It wasn't Drill Right, but it was a drilling automation system that we built to – it had like a little radar, and it would show drilling problems coming in based on different aspects of the of the drilling, you know, location.
Okay.
And all the different parameters coming in, data and analytics.
Yeah.
So back then, nobody really did data analytics, right?
It's huge now.
Yeah. And I was kind of at the forefront of that.
A little pioneer.
And it was Drill Edge, that's what the name
okay.
of the was.
Okay.
Drill Edge came in, I analyzed the software, and I gave my, you know, viewpoint of the software and my recommendation. Okay. I liked it, but there were some things we wanted to tweak, and the Marathon had their technology group build their own software system. Based on my input on that software.
Okay, so you got the internship with drilling, mm-hmm. and so bring us to kind of so you got on with who? So after college, you got on
Marathon. Yeah,
okay.
So was working for Marathon. They put me in. I was in East Texas as an intern. And then when I first started, you know, full time, I was in Woodford Shale.
Okay,
so I go up to Woodford Shale, and back then Woodford was just now kicking off.
All right,
so graduated, go up there. And we were bringing out new rigs. So HP 224 was a brand new rig back then. Or sorry, not 224, 435. 224 was in East Texas.
That's right.
We brought 435 out, brand new, from the yard. And I'm thinking, brand new rig is like a Cadillac. It's the best thing, right? No, it's not, because everything's in a box. Nothing's in the right place. But I spent so much time just trying to learn that. And I had some good contacts of the field and everything. And you know, since I already had that background and everything, I kind of started off working nights and then foreshadowed a guy during the days. And, you know, Marathon's training process was so good because Jeff Day, excellent guy. I mean, I think the world of him. Just text him this morning, you know, see how he's doing.
All right.
But he said, you know, if I put people in the field, I want people to run the location efficiently and proficient for at least two or three hitches on days. So that was your key. That was your key to the office.
Right.
So I was like, well, of course I'm going to do that, right? So I'd go out there, and it was working 2-2, which I never saw 2-2
yeah.
the whole year. I went up there, brand new rig, and you know, 2 weeks was up. Let's go back to Houston. I got 2 weeks off, but I always go in the office anyway. And they were like, okay, now go to H&P's yard and bring the new rig up. So I brought 7 rigs up, brand new.
Talk about a learning experience, too.
Yeah, so you do the leadership program at H&P. They're in trying to think exactly where in Houston it is. I guess
it's Bell. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think it's like I-10, but I can't remember now. But yeah, you would go there and they would do, you know, forklift training, manlift
right.
training, everything, and then you get a good, you know, feel for the whole crew going to be working there. And then when you go up there, you're working with the same guys. And then we had Charlie Rhodes like leadership course.
Yeah.
And it was a learning experience, right? And I just kind of told myself, look, I'm going to make days in 3 months. You know, I'm going to be working days in 3 months. And I was there in actually 3 hitches.
Oh, okay.
And then I work in days, and I'm like, okay, here's my shot. And I was always high strung. I always had a lot of energy, and I didn't drink coffee back then.
I want to get to the coffee. Yeah.
So, you know, Rocky Richardson was my my superintendent back then, Ray Brewer. And they played kind of a joke on me. Not a joke, but.
What was it?
they set me up, right? They're like, okay, JD, you know, back then, my name's John Smith, so I went by John at Marathon, then later on, JD.
All right.
So they're like, hey, John, look, this is a science well. We need to drill here. You need to get a whipstock set up. We're gonna do a sidetrack. And I'm like, sidetrack? Never done that before. And I'm like, just calling everybody I know. I'm calling my dad. Do you have any contacts? I'm calling this guy. And, you know, I set everything up, and I had everything written out to the T, right?
Right.
And then I work on this for like 2 days. And then on the third day, Rocky comes out there and is like, okay, John, we're going to just drill the lateral as planned. We were just joking with you. And I'm like, man, I've been stressing for 48 hours here. Like, what's going on? He's like, well, it was just a test you passed, and we know you could run it, you know, set everything up.
Right.
And I was calling all these service companies, and they were calling them because I'd say, okay, I got Weatherford set up. I got Smith, all these guys. And they were calling them and say, look, we don't need that. Don't send it out.
Oh, so it was a real world test.
Yeah,
it was a
yeah. And I'm throwing the wolves there. I have no good contacts. I got to get all these contacts myself in 48 hours.
Well, what an experience, though.
Yeah, it's very good.
I mean, it's a pain in the ass. Don't get me wrong. I think there's other ways to do it, but I mean, at the same time, I mean, talk about sink or swim. I mean,
yep, it's sink or swim.
Yeah,
yeah. And I always tell people, like, the guys I work with, one of my night guys, Michael Neal and Jim Walker, they were just like, look, you know, I know you don't think you're ready for this, but you are. You know, nobody thinks that – you never think you're ready
or fully ready. No.
So I was like –
and you should be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, so I was like, well, I'm uncomfortable, but they're like, you can do it. So they were rooting me on, and they were helping me out, and they were wanting me to progress, right?
All right. So you made days.
Yeah, so I made days, worked in the office, went to the office, worked in Woodford, yep. Did that for a little bit, did South Texas right when they kicked off, and then – Jeff comes to my office one day and says, look, you know, I always shown interest in international drilling.
Yeah.
So he said, hey, there's an opportunity.
You got the international experience.
Yeah. They were like, there's an opportunity in Norway coming up.
Okay.
And I said, okay. He said, I've chose you and Emily to go over there, Emily Rule. So they said, we're going to go to Norway and you're going to work as an offshore drill engineer.
Cool.
So I was like, oh, this is like the best news ever, right? Because international, I worked international. I saw my dad always do that.
There's worse places.
And offshore, right?
There's also worse places to be stationed internationally.
So I'm in, like, you know, the best place.
Yeah.
Right? So I go to Stavanger. I, you know, work in that group there, worked offshore. I've never been offshore before. I go to...
Oh, that was your first offshore experience?
Yeah, first one.
North Sea.
And I go to cold water survival training, and they put the fake helicopter in the water and they flip it over.
The egress training?
Yeah, and I'm like... What the hell I get into, right?
Yeah, it's also the EU regulation. I'm not is Norway anyway. Those regulations are very
Norsok, yeah.
Yeah, those are very very stringent. Yeah,
yeah. So I worked off. You know, I was there all of 2012.
Okay,
worked in Norway. Great learning experience. Right, learned some great met some great guys. You know, I was an offshore drill engineer, so I wasn't a supervisor. But at the very end, they let me work nights a couple hitches.
Cool.
But I had a mentor with me, right? So you learn all that, and my boss always told me.
Which rig was it?
Oh, the Transocean Winner.
Okay.
Yeah, so my boss always told me, and I hate using that word, my dad always told me there's no boss in the oil field. There's leaders and managers.
I like that. I agree with that.
And so my manager at the time said, look, you only get one mess up that's worth $1 million in the oil field. And the problem with that is in Norway it's a day. So we were paying like $600,000 a day for the rig and then $400,000 spread rate, right? So about $1 million a day. So did all that. And then the contract ended. We had like a partnership with Statoil and I think it was, can't remember the other company, but we shared a rig. It was a 5-year contract with three companies.
Okay.
So, you know, we give the rig back to Statoil and then I'm done with my work there, right? And they're like, how's North Dakota sound? I said, I'll try it out. But it was in November. So I go up there. It's so cold, but I learned so much up there.
Yeah.
Worked for a guy up there, really good. I love the experience, but through connections and through some, you know, people that I know, they said, look, if you're looking for a change, you know, around like March timeframe, they said, you ever heard of BHP Billiton? I said, no. Well, they need engineers. And they said, if you want to get back to Houston, because I was going up there rotation. My wife was working for Lynn Energy in Houston.
Yeah.
As an accountant. So I was like, well, I want to get back to Houston, you know, and work an office job because I've been Yeah, you've traveled so much.
You've been traveling the past couple of years. You've been in the field. You got that experience. It's time for something else. I get it.
Yeah. So I went over to BHP and I interviewed with two companies at the same time in December.
Okay. And this is December
2012.
Okay.
And I started in March, but interview with BHP and BG.
BG.
So BG Group is my connections to Bolivia.
Okay.
So when I went down there and Shell bought them out.
Okay.
So I interviewed with both, and the BG people, they were, you know, we're going to hire some. We don't know the time frame, right? Well, BHP offered me a job right off the bat, so I just went with them. And I actually got my connections to BG playing golf down in Bolivia on a trip down there for December, you know, for Christmas.
Yeah.
So I go to BHP, worked Eagle Ford Shell for a while, and, you know, when you're working in the office, you're so close to the field. We were in Cuero. So it's like nobody would go – the engineers would just spend all day, all week in their office, and they wouldn't go to the field. Well, I'd get all my work done by Tuesday, and I was in the field Wednesday and Thursday and come back Friday.
Okay.
So I just loved just going out there, and they liked that because I was an engineer actually going to spend time with the company man.
Oh, that speaks volumes.
Yeah.
It really does. I mean, just as you said, not boss. That's leadership right there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that, and then unfortunately my stint at BHP ended – short,
okay.
Because BG had called me and said, "Look, we have an expat position open in Bolivia, Santa Cruz, which is where my wife's from."
Okay. Oh, so she's from there,
from that same town.
Okay.
And so I said, "Okay, this is a big step." I go home and I'm like, "Look, honey, I know you work for Lynn, but look, I got this opportunity on the table here. I can't turn it down." And she said, "I don't think I want to leave Houston. I like Houston." I said, "Yeah, but it's your hometown. You know, your family's still there and everything. Let's try it out." And she'd been in the States ever since she graduated high school, right?
Okay.
So finally made that leap and took the job offer. Had to tell my boss at the time, Michael Bloom, I'm leaving. And he's like, "Oh, no." Because I said, "Hey, Michael, can I talk to you?" And he's like, "Shoot, I just knew what was coming." And back then in 2013, it was a huge boom in the industry.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like things happened for a reason, and it did happen for a reason because I signed a contract for 3 years with BG, and the next year the downturn started, right?
Yeah.
So I was kind of protected under my contract down there.
And so were you an expat down in Bolivia
yes.
at this time? Okay, okay.
Yeah, so I go work for BG down there. They move me down, and they're like, "You're going to be an expat." My dad was an expat growing up, and we lived all over the world, and he's like, "Okay." You know, they give you a company car, they pay for your house. If you have kids, they pay for the school. It was like pretty crazy.
Life.
And I'm like 25 at this time, 25 years old. I was the youngest.
I feel like the resume you just gave me, you should be like 35. Okay, so yeah. 25 this time, young, just like go-getter, in the office 2 days, in the field. I love that. All right.
Yeah, so I'm, you know, the youngest lead drill engineer for BG Group at the time.
Okay.
So I go down there. You know, I'm 32 now, and I never really talked about age with people because I always thought it was a setback for me because I was so young, but I'd done so much, and I always didn't want the viewpoint of people going, "Oh, this guy is moving up too quick," and maybe, like you've been saying in your other podcasts, like people look at other people's stuff, and it's like, well, why I'm not there, right?
It's comparisons.
And
comparison
I get stuck
culture.
In there. And I get stuck in that, too.
And the worst part is, though, once you get in that mode, I mean, you don't want people viewing you. It's like holding you back just because of your age and you're a firecracker, go-getter, whatever you want to call it. It's a difficult thing because, again, it's egos.
Yeah.
You got to deal with the egos of some people. So
I go down there and start off first day. I walk in the office, and Donald Wright is my supervisor.
Okay.
He's a drilling manager. I go work for him, and he's the guy that I bought my coffee farm from. So this is the relation here.
Yes.
So I get down there, and me and him had a mutual contact that I played golf with, and that's how I actually interviewed for the job.
Okay.
I was down there playing golf with my buddy. He said, "Hey, you're a drilling guy. They're looking for a drilling guy. Put your resume in." I was like, "Nah, they won't want me. I don't have that experience." He's like, "No, you can't lose. Just throw it in there."
Right.
The worst they can say is no, right? So I get there. He's like, "Oh, yeah, you know Richard," and we start talking, right? And he goes, "You drink coffee?" I said, "Nah, I don't drink coffee." He's like, "You don't drink coffee? What? No, you got to drink coffee working for me. I own a coffee farm, for God's sakes." You know, I was like, "Okay, I'll try a cup."
Is Bolivia, is it a strong coffee culture?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, they have a lot of coffee farms there, but it's not
as far as their culture, it's not part of it. It's just that
everybody drinks coffee there.
Right.
But it's like Nescafe instant coffee.
Gotcha.
That's the go-to. Every house, even my house there down there has it just because it's just easy to make.
Okay.
So he sends me home with a kilo bag, you know, You know, I'm in the States, pound, down there, kilo. Send me home. And
it sounds cooler, a kilo, by the way.
Exactly. So I take this bag home. I give it to my wife, and she's like, where'd that coffee come from? I was like, Don's got this coffee farm. Hell, I don't know. I said, is it good? You know, I don't know. I said, just try it. And she said, oh, it's really good.
Is she a coffee drinker?
Oh, she was a big coffee drinker.
Okay.
And still is.
Okay.
And so she's like, I love the coffee. I said, okay, I'll tell Don, whatever. But, you know, I butchered it with milk and cream and sugar and everything. So started drinking like that. And he's like, you know, I can deal with the sugar. We're going to have to lose the cream. So long story short, I created a bond with him at this point. And he's like, you like whiskey? I said, I love whiskey.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I got 100 bottles at my farm that I go there and just drink by myself with a buddy of mine.
And this is the coffee growing.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
So he's like, how about you come up this weekend, bring the wife. My wife will be there. I got 3 extra bedrooms. And, hey, come up there and just stay, you know. And so, okay, I'll go up there. So I go up there, drink whiskey, and roast coffee all weekend. It's like the dream, right? And kind of full circle, the coffee farm used to be owned when I used to live there by my dad's good friend. So I had actually been to his farm but didn't know it at the time back in 98.
What was the farm called back then?
It never had a name.
So, okay, all right.
We're kind of calling it Cuevas Coffee Farm.
Okay, okay. Yeah. And that's it? Okay.
It's in Samipata, Bolivia. So that's about 2 hours from Santa Cruz, Bolivia, town.
Can you say that again?
Yeah, Samipata. It's Samipata.
Oh, I'm on it. I got it.
Yeah, Samipata. And you can go on our website. That's where all those all the pictures taken from. That's my
beautiful farm down there.
Yeah, it's actually El Codo de los Andes, is the elbow of the Andes. Yeah.
Let's time it out because this is the I want to get. Let's so you go to this place. You're drinking bourbon. You're drinking whiskey, and you're having some. You're having roasting coffee. You know, your wife's there. She's seeing this. So go on.
Yeah. So it's just a zen place, right?
I mean,
it's just, you know, breathtaking views. No cell reception.
I love that.
It's the best, you know, because when I go up there, I leave my cell, you know, in the house. I never check it.
Doesn't it feel good?
I check it at the end of the day.
Doesn't it feel good, though?
Well, I'd love
to do that. Yeah. It kind of feels weird when you first do
that. You have to unplug.
And then you have to unplug, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's great hiking around there. You know, my wife was just there last weekend. She's down in Bolivia right now and went hiking. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a good getaway place, right?
Okay.
So go through that. I'm down there for 3 years in Santa Cruz working for BG Group. And then Shell buys us like in 2015.
So are you going to this farm? So have you created a relationship with this guy and you're going to this farm a little bit more?
Yeah, he's my supervisor.
So
right?
You're kind of making a regular thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was his passion, right? And he was just like, look, I want to do this. And I was giving ideas and, you know, let's do this with it or, hey, try this out, try that out.
Yeah,
and
just kind of just sitting around bullshitting over a glass of whiskey and being like, what if we do this? What if we do this? What do you think about this?
Yeah. Ideas.
Cool.
And then 3 years later, I'm a coffee drinking fool, you know, like I love coffee at this point, right? And, you know, we did some other business ventures. I'm an entrepreneur. I love doing, you know, startup businesses.
Okay.
So we started a taxi company we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
40 cars and everything. And that went well. And then we sold that out and decided to, you know, I worked for BG, well, Shell, until about end of 2016.
Okay.
So I kind of left there, ran some, you know, personal businesses and, you know, was kind of trying to get out of the oil field. It was my route out.
Yeah, that was. I mean, 2016. That was kind of when things were still kind of in the. They were better off than now, but still, they were in the gutter. Yeah.
I remember leaving Shell. The HR manager met with me, and they sat down at the table, and they said, "We're going to give you resources to find a new job and everything, you know." And I did voluntary redundancy, so I took the package and left. Mm-hmm. And they're like, "Okay, look, we have all this, you know, stuff. We got, you know, Cobra insurance, all this. You know, when you go back to the States," I said, "I'm not going back to the States." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, my wife's from here. We own a house here. We're going to stay." And, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know. Probably play golf 6 days a week and go roast coffee on the weekends." And she's like, "Really?"
So this coffee play, it was just kind of a hobby. Like, yeah, it'll fill my time a little bit.
Yeah, hobby at first.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't involved in the farm. You know, I was involved in growing the farm with the old owner, but I hadn't bought into it yet.
Right.
So I leave Shell and kind of hanging out until January, and a buddy of mine here in the States calls, says, "Hey, you want to be a completion superintendent?" And I said, "Man, I'm a drilling guy.
Yeah.
I don't know about nothing about frack." He's like, "Yeah, but you're a leader." And I didn't realize at that time, like we discussed, it's leadership. It's not, you know, the knowledge base, exactly.
And it's not even knowing you're a leader. It's more of a, I feel like a lot of times leadership is people think it's title. People think it's a certain number of years. It's not that. I mean, there's some leaders that are fresh in the industry or any industry. And it's to me, it's attitude.
Yeah.
To me, it's that. I'm not a, you know, leadership expert or guru, but to me, it's attitude and motivation. I mean, can you circle people around you and go towards a common goal? It doesn't matter what age you are.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I've seen some other podcasts you do, and it's like, what, you know, job best developed you?
Yeah,
I think they all did, but the best development managerially wise was BG Group.
Okay,
because Don, my old boss, he was a field guy. He wasn't a manager. And he wanted to go to the field all the time. We were drilling wells.
Yeah.
He'd go out there and just spend his time there and just leave me with everything to do in the office. Well, 26 at the time or 27, you know, been there about a year or two. And it's like, I got to talk to management. I got to talk to London every day. I got to talk to Richard Lancaster in Houston. I mean, some really good guys that are, you know, 60.
But did you like that aspect of it?
I loved it.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It taught me so much.
Okay.
Like Richard Lancaster, I don't know, he's kind of a hidden, you know, diamond in the rough in the oil field, but really paid a lot of, you know, payment to my success.
Okay.
I mean, he was one of the best engineers, would work 7 days a week, married to his job, right? So, you know, he would call me and we'd be on the phone for like, you know, 3 hours. Well, this guy is the chief well engineer for BG Group. And we have like, I don't know, 20 assets.
All right.
And I'm like, why does he have time for 3 hours twice a week for me? You know, he's got 20 other assets,
yeah.
But he would take that time and spend with you. And you would send him an email. And for Richard, if it says, looks very good, you know, for him, for most people, it looks good. But for him, he still has a lot of input, right?
Right.
So he said, yeah, it looks very good, but here's my comments. And then he's like just red ink all over the email, right? But it helped me because he just like taught me a lot and how to actually forecast everything. I did all the P&A liabilities and everything, and did the spreadsheet to present to management and present for the you know, budgeting, right?
And, so you're fine tuning your corporate skills now.
Yeah.
All right.
So, you know, then later on, I got promoted to Wells team leader, you know, operations superintendent, and you know, it just grew me as an individual so much.
Right? Okay.
So, moved back to the States. You know, living in Katy, or actually living in Shiner, actually working completion superintendent for Penn, Virginia.
Okay.
Go out there and, you know, I didn't know nothing about frac. So I had a lot of guys. I still keep in contact with the team every day. Still talk to the guys.
So you got to the bottom five and surround yourself with some people that could teach you.
Yeah. So I figured out who the main frac guys were. And I sat down with them and learned everything. I knew who the pump down engineers were or who the pump down consultants were. They were really good and just sat down with them.
Okay.
Well, you know, at the time they thought I was bird dogging them. But I wasn't. I was trying to learn.
You got to build their trust.
I was staying at a hotel for the first 6 months.
All right.
So it was kind of one of those things. It was, you know, Penn had been bankrupt and I took the job and I said, well, I'm not going to go buy a house or anything. I'm just going to kind of feel it out a little bit, then move my family later, right?
Yeah.
So they're still in Bolivia. I go 6 months and I'm living in a hotel and I'm on location 20 hours a day.
And this is what year is this?
2017.
So your daughter was just born.
She was being born that year.
Okay.
So didn't see my wife much until she was born. Then I went, spent a month in Bolivia when she was born. And then we moved back right after she was born.
Okay.
So I was on location for 20 hours, 22 hours a day. Sometimes I'd just sleep on the couch. And they were like, what's JD doing? I mean, why is he here all the time? You know, like, is he going to run us off? And I'm like, no, I'm learning. Like, I don't know how to frack a whale. But, you know, I got really good at it at the very end, you know. I mean, because I just spent so much time with these guys and just poured all my efforts into it, right?
It's funny. At first, they didn't trust you. You're this the corporate guy coming out there, and through building that relationship, it's like, okay, well, he just wants to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I know the drilling manager, and it's like, well, who's this guy? You know, it's just, this guy's going to come in, bring his own people. Didn't change a thing.
Yeah.
I only had to let go one guy because of
– different reasons.
Totally different.
Right? Yeah, okay, yeah.
But – kept everybody on, added people and everything, had a great time.
Yeah, you weren't there to go in and clean house and change everything out. You're going there to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of laugh at about it today, but we had probably one of the best, you know, frac groups in the industry, you know, doing, you know, 4 million pounds a day.
All right.
Of sand, you know, damn. I don't know, 100,000 barrels of water a day. So, you know, 8 to 10 stages a day.
So you do
average
that?
7.5 or 8. And I do it. I'm a drilling guy.
Yeah.
But I had the guys below me that added to that, you know, added to that great, right. That great team, right?
So you're doing that. And then,
so 2017, you know, I'm kind of just, you know, filling my role out. Don calls me up. He's from Del Rio, Texas. And he said, look, he was working in Paraguay for a company. He said, look, I'm moving back to Corpus. And I said, what are you going to do with everything in Bolivia? I really haven't thought about it. Probably sell it. I said, well, I'll buy it. He said, I haven't told you price yet. I said, I don't care. I'll buy it.
And when was this again?
2017.
Okay.
So I said, I'll buy it, you know, whatever. Just name the price. We're buddies. I know you're not going to mess me over. Right. I'll buy it. Okay. So he's like, okay, I haven't even talked to anybody, but yeah, I'll sell it to you.
All right.
So I buy the farm, and then we take over, right? And we're kind of just, you know, building it up. We're doing soil analysis. We're doing all the analytics that we need to do with it, right?
Okay.
To help build it. We have 20,000 plants currently.
And so you bought this. I mean, what was your goal with buying this farm? Was it to continue to grow and to distribute, to sell, to open up your own shop? I mean, what was the goal of just buying a farm in Bolivia?
Just to hang out and drink whiskey on?
I dig that, man. Hey, hey, buddy boy, I dig that, man.
No, really, that was the main goal. It's like, yeah, I guess the coffee makes some money, but I'll have a place to go chill and relax.
In the mountains.
And drink
whiskey. In the mountains of South America.
Yeah.
I like that. Okay.
So that, I didn't have no plan or vision for it. You know, I knew eventually I wanted to work on an exportation license. I wanted to build my own brand. But
that's the entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so let's take a step and we get to this year, 2020. You know, I kind of...
You want any more?
No, I'm good.
Okay, I'm good. So I'm going to get my third cup.
Started looking around and I'm at that 3-year mark with this company and, you know, kind of achieved everything we had to achieve and didn't know no downturn was coming, you know, and kind of... Came to a mutual agreement, me and my supervisor at the time was, hey, look, let's part ways. I'm ready to get out of it. I want to focus on this. Okay, you know, no hard feelings. Let's just cut ties, right? Okay. And I traveled to Colombia to look at a P&A project with Ecopetrol in late January. And I know because I was sitting at the airport that Sunday. It was the Sunday that Kobe died, Kobe Bryant.
Yeah,
and I'm looking at this on. I'm having a burger, waiting my buddy to meet me there. And we're traveling to Colombia together, Bogota, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, oh shoot, you know, reading the, you know, just watching the news. Yeah. I don't watch the news.
I don't either.
And
cheers to that.
Yeah. So we're watching the news, and I hear COVID. I'm like, what the hell is this COVID?
Yeah.
What are they talking about? And then my buddy gets there. He's from the UK. We're flying down. He's like, oh yeah. It's going to shut the world down. And I said, what? There's no way. And he's like, yeah, it's going to shut the world down. So really? Okay. And, you know, looking back financially, it made sense. And I cashed out my 401k.
Okay.
So I kind of dodged a bullet.
Okay.
I didn't know at the time because he said, it's going to shut it down. Look, it's going to go to shit, the whole world. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah, it's going to.
How wrong was he, huh?
Yeah. Well, I was just like, this guy's nuts, you know? So we go down there for a week, come back. And then I'm kind of like, look, I'm tired of the oil field. I want to do this coffee thing.
Yeah.
I want to do something in coffee. And we were working on the exportation license. I had some good contacts that was helping me out with it. I said, okay, finally, I think we discussed it earlier, March 6th or something like that.
Something like that.
The Friday before the crash, like we just decided to part ways, shook hands. Okay. You know, if I go back in the oil field, I'll give you a shout or something. Right. And I leave. And, you know, it was kind of a, you know, uncertain times, like, you don't have a paycheck anymore. You're about to go be an entrepreneur and entrepreneurs.
So what is the motivation behind? I guess just saying, okay, I'm gonna hang up my oil field hard hat for a little bit. And I'm gonna pursue this. I mean, was it because of COVID, or was it just something that you're like, you know what? I think I'm motivated by this. This is something new that I want to learn.
You know,
what was it?
My daughter was getting older.
Yeah,
I was working over 300 days a year.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, you know. It sucks working Sundays and you're getting calls all day long and, you know, fishing operations and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, look, let's just take a break. You know, it's such a fast-paced environment. Let's take a break.
Right.
And I can spend time with my wife and kids. And then, you know, my wife was pregnant at the time with our second child. So it's like, look, let's hang it up and let's just focus on this.
Okay.
So I leave. Crash hits Monday. Okay. I always had the, you know, fallback option. If anything happened or if I need, you know, get in a bind, I can just go work on a rig, right?
Yeah. Well,
that's kind of out the window.
Not anymore. Not anymore.
So it's kind of like, you know, very trying times, and the world's shutting down. They cancel the basketball season. Mm-hmm. They cancel the rodeo. Yep. And we're just like, what's going on, right? Yep. And I said, well, I still want to do this dream of mine. You know, let's focus on that. And then we were going to fly back to Bolivia, and we're going to see the whole harvest process and everything. I never seen the whole harvest process of the coffee. And travel restrictions hit us. So
are you stuck in the States?
Yeah, okay. I got stuck in the States.
Okay.
So I go up. My dad's got a place in Oklahoma. We get quarantined up there. I got rid of my house and everything because I was moving back to Bolivia.
Yeah.
And my goal was to move to Bolivia, export my coffee, and didn't really know what kind of brand I was going to put it in, but just, you know, export my coffee and make money that way, right?
So pretty much you start off with buying a coffee farm. Is that what it's called, coffee farm?
Yeah.
You end up buying a coffee farm from a buddy of yours, mm-hmm. right? No name to it. You kind of don't know the process. The only thing you know about coffee is you like talking about it when you're drinking whiskey.
Well, I knew the process. I learned that over the time. I just hadn't seen it firsthand being picked.
Okay. All right.
Understood everything.
So here you are, middle of COVID, or COVID first hit, and, you know, you're being quarantined and all this stuff, and you want to pursue this, and this, you know, this is Cuevas Coffee has not started yet. The farm is there, the land is there, mm-hmm. the beans are growing, but however the brand in it is not there.
Yeah.
Okay. So
brand's not there.
Let's talk about this now. So you're pursuing your passion now. You want to do this.
Yep.
So let's go down this road.
Yeah. So my brother-in-law, good friend of mine, Ruben Cisneros, he's the co-founder of the company.
Okay.
He lives in Austin, and we're just sitting in his house one day and kind of, okay, we always told ourselves we leave the oil field, let's just go and do coffee. So it's like I had his support. We were both investors, and it's like, okay, let's do something with this. My family is very artistic.
Okay.
And they're, you know, very outside, you know, out of the box thinkers and everything. So I hooked up with my cousin, and, you know, she's a she went to UT, I went to OU, so it's kind of, you know,
yeah.
Love hate there.
Family feud, yeah.
So I start talking to her. I said, look, you're a very creative person. You're very artistic. We want to create a brand. And she said, what do you think? I said, look, I get writer's block when I look at a piece of paper. And you have all these ideas, but it's like, what comes to mind?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So she's like, okay, just send me a list of things of what was around the farm, right? So around our farm is Cuevas, Bolivia, is a little town.
Okay.
And they have waterfalls there, right?
Yep.
But you can see the waterfall kind of on this picture here. On the front there, on the bottom.
Yep.
So it's called Cuevas, and she's like, what about Cuevas coffee roasters?
I see the waterfalls. Yeah, I'm on. I'm looking at Cuevas, Bolivia right now.
Yeah, so
pretty.
She said, what about Cuevas coffee roasters? And it was kind of a different logo at first that she just pulled off the internet.
Right.
And I said, yeah, I like that. And I said, told my wife and told my brother-in-law, I said, look, hey, Ruben, hey, Carly, you like this? Yeah, you know, we kind of like the name. And I said, I'm set on it. Let's just go with it.
Okay.
So I said, let's just use that logo. And she said, no, look, I pulled the internet. We need to make it more trademark.
Right.
Like more able to trademark.
Original. It needs to be more original.
So she said, look, I'm not the person for that. But my brother-in-law, which has, you know, been married to my other cousin for a long time.
Yeah.
Ex Frito-Lay people said, look, have him design your logo. Stephen Grigsby.
Okay.
And he puts this together, and we go back and forth. We're looking at it. And at this point in time, we didn't know if we wanted a brand.
You know what's funny? I'm sorry. I'm not interrupting. I'm actually looking at your logo right now on the coffee bag. And I'm actually looking at Google right now, and I'm seeing the same waterfall. That's that's pretty cool. Yeah. So anyway, sorry. Go on. I just noticed that.
So, you know, he said, what are you looking for, you know, in a business? I said, well, we want a coffee roasting company, but we may want a coffee shop.
Yeah.
So, and I can't say the name now because we're still working on trademarking rights.
Okay.
But we had a name for a coffee shop, and we also had a name for a coffee roasting
company. Okay.
So I said, look, let's be a manufacturer first, and then we'll go into serving the public, right? Because at this point in time, we're like, look, it's COVID. If you don't have a drive-through, if you're not in the perfect location, if you don't have enough, you know, road traffic, you're kind of out in the water, you know? I mean, you're not going to make it. And, you know, buying equipment for a coffee shop is quite expensive. Now, roasters aren't cheap either. So it's like, okay, let's do the manufacturing process. Let's get that down to a T. Let's produce great coffee. And then we'll move into a coffee shop.
So I'll put the cart before the horse, yeah.
Yeah. So we designed this whole bag. Everything looks good. He kind of added the little bean for the sun there.
I dig it.
Have the because cuevas means caves. It translates to caves in English.
Okay.
So that's why there's a little cave there.
I like
and it. And on my land, because we have 100 acres on the farm, and then we have 640-acre, like a section of land that's on a mesa mountain.
Okay.
And a lot of people hike there. It's a very tourist attraction. And there's a cave on that land. So it kind of, you know, all ties together.
Yeah, it all ties in.
So we said, okay, that's going to be our logo. Let's work on the bags. And we start putting the bags together and stuff. I really dig it, you know. And, you know,
What'd you dig about it? Did you just dig the whole kind of process of kind of like taking this idea and just kind of actually seeing it kind of come to fruition, like the design of it, the branding?
You know, everybody, they say this. I've heard this quote a lot. I don't know who came up with it, but you know, everybody has $1 million ideas all day long.
Okay.
Everybody has $1 million idea every day.
Right.
It's those who act on it that actually make it happen, right? So unless you act on something, you're not gonna make it happen.
Yeah.
So it's like whenever you have an idea and you're like, yeah, I'd love to do that. And some people only get to that point. Yeah, I'd love to do that.
I think a lot of people get to that point.
Yeah, most. And then the people that actually go, I'd love to do that, let's do it. And that's what we did.
Okay.
And we made it happen. And like whenever you see a dream of yours develop into a finished final product, and you know, I know a lot of people in the industry that do, you know, marketing for brands, mm-hmm. and they're like, look, your branding is amazing, right? Your packaging and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like sound my own horn, but you know, it is. I like the bag.
Toot your own. Yeah. This is your company. Yeah. Toot your own horn, man. This looks cool. Looks great. It looks. And I like the little. It says, "Give it a squeeze and breathe in the goodness," and it smells really good.
Yeah. So my the guy that designed the bag, he did a contract assignment for Dick's Last Resort.
Yeah.
And he actually named all the menu items.
Okay.
So he's like, he likes doing that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So he's like, look, this looks pretty good. And we're working on a few blends right now that we're kind of getting creative with. So it's pretty interesting.
That's
going to
be
that.
A fun process. So I want to talk
that's
about
a good, that's a good whiskey drinking exercise.
The what?
Coming up with new names.
New names, new blends. Oh, yeah. I'll bet we'll get creative with that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many can hit the shelves. So you got this land, you're getting the bag, you're getting the brand, you're kind of putting all this together. So what, I guess, how would you, I guess, position yourself in the coffee market? Because I feel like it's not just, people think, you know, coffee's coffee, or, oh, I like this brand, I like their Starbucks. How are y'all positioning yourself in the coffee market? Because people that do drink coffee and do appreciate coffee, it is kind of like, it is like a wine, a whiskey, a cigar. It's something that that people appreciate. You know, you develop a taste for it. So what is kind of y'all's
So our niche and our goal and our target is, you know, coffee is like wine.
Yep.
It's rated on a scale from 1 to 100. You could probably get a wine close to 100. You can't give coffee near 100 at all.
Okay.
I mean, why? I think like 99 is the highest. It's just because it's never been, you know, it's never been scored that high.
Okay.
And there's a geisha, there's a plant called Geisha. We're planting 12,000 plants at the farm right now with this. It's the highest scoring coffee in the world. It scored a 92 in Bolivia in the same competition we were in, that we were in the top 15.
Where are these? Wait, hold on a second. Say that again.
We were the top 15 in a Bolivia national coffee competition.
Really?
Yeah, top 15 and 600 farms. That was 2018.
Damn. Okay. That's cool. All right.
Yeah. No, 19. Sorry, last year.
So there's
canceled this year.
So COVID.
Yeah.
COVID. So there's coffee competition. So how does one become a coffee connoisseur or a sommelier de la café?
Yeah, you know, a good buddy of mine, he started a coffee company in Bolivia called Patrimonio.
Okay.
Eddie Bion. But he kind of explained to me how it all worked and kind of got me interested in it, right? Because before I was like, yeah, we have plants, it's cool, but I didn't know the background of it. Like, what does terroir mean, right? It's where it's grown.
Right.
Or what is the actual species of plant? Or I didn't know all this.
So this gives you an opportunity to kind of dive in.
Yeah. So I referred to him for a lot of information, but also, like I told you, I've done about 150 hours of online learning, and a mentor of mine in the coffee business.
What do you mean online learning? What online learning?
So there's we joined Boot Coffee Campus. And that's, you can go on there and check them out. Okay. You pay like $400 the first year, and it gets you these coffee courses, right? And there's 12 modules, and each module was like a couple hours, 3 hours.
Okay.
We do those, and then they have like Zoom meetings now.
Yeah.
It's usually in person, but now they're doing a lot of Zoom lately and stuff like that. So Will and Boot, they have a coffee farm in Panama, really good guys, very knowledgeable, very well known. Very well known in the coffee world.
Yeah.
So we start taking these courses and we're just learning stuff that we need to be experts on, right? We're going to have a coffee brand. I need to be the expert of this,
yeah.
Right? So just give you background on coffee. There's first wave, second wave, and third wave. So first wave coffee is your red can coffee.
That's the Folgers.
Yeah. I've heard you call it out on your podcast before, but, you know.
What?
Since you know, Folgers. Well, so since you know me now, you're only going to drink Cubas, right?
Well, come on. First off, absolutely. But look, the only reason I'm saying Folgers is it's a household name. It's on the rig. I mean, it's
Folgers in your cup.
Yeah, exactly.
Cuevas in your cup.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you have first wave coffee, which is red canned coffee.
Okay.
So that is everything from 0 to 75 score
and
coffee scale.
I'm not bullshitting you, by the way. This is really good. Oh, yeah. I'm not just saying that. So anyway, go on. So 0 to 75
up to 80 is first wave coffee.
Okay.
You know, this is just, you know, the cheapest coffee around, wherever they can buy. It's actually a different type of plant. So you have in coffee, you have two different species. One is a Robusto.
Okay.
And one's Arabica. So you always hear Arabica coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
Arabica coffee is a shrub. Robusta is actually a tree.
Okay.
So they mechanically harvest Robusta, and you can't find whole bean Folgers, can you?
I don't think so.
Guaranteed not.
Okay.
Because it's got twigs, it's got everything in there, right? Because it's hard. They don't have all the machinery to
the do pruning, all the pruning, yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Okay.
They just shake the tree, it falls down, and, you know, there's.
Throw it in a cup, call it a day.
Ripe ones, non ripe ones, they just roast it all, right?
Okay.
So you have that first wave, which Community falls in there. I used to drink Community. You know, and I know you have a lot of Louisiana listeners, community. It's like they're married to that brand.
I know that. I know.
So that's the first wave coffee. Okay. The second wave coffee is like Dunkin' Donuts, Pete's, Parks, and Starbucks.
Okay.
So in the world.
What is that? 70, 80 to what?
No, it's 80 what? To 85.
Okay. Second.
Actually, Starbucks sets their par at 80. And they only buy 78 to 82 coffee and blend it all together.
Oh.
And you've heard the term charbucks, which I don't like to, you know, badmouth the competition, but they burn their coffee because it's very hard to do a QAQC process.
Yeah, right? Okay.
Yeah, tongue twister.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, so I do too.
It's hard to do a QAQC process on if you sell 4 billion pounds of coffee a year, right? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
In the world, they estimate about 25 to 30 billion pounds are consumed a year, and about 8 are consumed in the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah, 8 billion pounds.
Yeah, I'm with you.
First wave probably accounts for about half of that market. Second wave is about, you know, up to 85-90%. And then the last, well, probably 95% even. The last 5 to 10% is third wave coffee roasters.
And this is the creme de la creme. Yes. This is the, okay.
So as we had our farm, we were in contact with different farmers and different importers and stuff and trying to find people that had the same values we have that, you know, they have.
And what are those values?
So our values are, you know, we're about to start doing some blogs on our website.
Okay.
You know, it helps SEO and everything. I'm new to marketing. You were saying you studied marketing, so I'm new to this.
Doesn't mean I know how to do it. Go on.
So the SEO is, you know, if you have blogs, you have more search engine optimization.
Okay.
So you can put, okay, hand-roasted coffee, Texas-made, small batch, et cetera, right? And what we do is, you know, we only spray – our coffee's not organic, and the only reason it's not organic, organic's total BS.
Dude, I know. Yeah. What is it like? If only, what, like 10% of the soil is organic, it's called organic, some bullshit like that.
Well, coffee's very hard to grow.
Why?
It's out. It can only be done outdoors. It needs to be grown at altitude, and it can't have a freeze.
Okay.
And there's a lot of bugs and insects that can infect the plants.
Okay.
And actually,
so it's a delicate. Yeah. Okay, it's a delicate crop.
Yeah. And some crops are actually ruined because there's insect damage.
So
if you don't use pesticides, you're kind of screwed.
So the third wave is the robust, is the trees, right?
No, third wave is the Arabica.
Arabica. Yep. That's what I meant. Okay.
And that's the top. That's 85 and above.
Gotcha.
Which is only 4% of the world's supply.
Okay.
So you have the third wave, which some third wave will use a little bit under 85. It's called specialty coffee.
Okay.
Specialty coffee, because Starbucks is so big in the industry, they paid money to have specialty coffee 80 and above because they can get it for a third of the cost I can get it for because it's a lower quality.
Okay.
But it's very easy to mess that bean up. So we want a high-quality coffee roasted at the potential to be a smooth and strong coffee.
Okay.
Still have a lot of caffeine in it, right?
Which, that's what this is.
So our max toxicity that we spray on our plants is a 4 out of 10. Most coffee you drink on the market is 9 out of 10. So we
what
can
is
actually,
what does that mean?
So a 9 out of 10 toxicity, right? So that's actually red band chemicals.
Okay.
Yellow band starts at a 4. Green band 0 to 3.
Okay.
So if it was green band, it would be organic. It can only be green band.
Which is a higher risk for insects and, yes. And ruined crops. Okay.
Coffee plants can probably live about 20 to 25 years. But organic plants, you're lucky to get eight years out of them. So you have to spray pesticide. Yeah. And that's what...
Listen to me. I'm fine with that, dude. Yeah. I'm okay with that.
So even though it's not organic, it still is very healthy for you.
Okay.
Coffee is actually, you know, it's a very good drink. You know, it's very beneficial health-wise for you. And if you drink it every day, they actually say it can reduce certain diseases like cancer, et cetera, right?
Right.
Only if it's done natural, right? So, you know, we work with these farms. We vet them, QAQC, and I get in contact with the owner. We just try to make sure, okay, we have this toxicity level. We are very sustainable. We help the people out. We pay a good price. And we make sure we're trying to drive down, you know, global, you know, poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's mostly grown in third world countries.
Well, that's also something, I mean, I went to y'all's website and
No, that's kind of our vision.
Yeah, no, I was saying, I mean, a portion of this goes back to the communities
where it's grown.
Yeah. Right, okay.
So we as farmers give back to our community. So we buy soccer balls for the local teams. The old owner built a church. They built a school or helped improve the school. So they've done a lot of great, you know, social responsibility.
So you're kind of taking the oil field community social responsibility and bringing it to the coffee world.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, we're kind of plant to cup almost. And we take it from the plant, put it in the cup.
I like that.
And, you know, in the coffee world, there's so many middlemen involved. It's just like oil traders, right? It's the same thing, I kind of assume. Is, you know, it gets sold to this guy. This guy buys it for this price. He adds 10 cents a pound and sells this guy. He adds 15 cents. And then it gets to the consumer, and you're paying a high price, but it could be lower, or it could be the same price, and portions of that proceeds
actually
go back to the
actually
farmer.
Help people, yeah.
Yeah, and now you have people that, you know, enjoy doing what they do, right? Because, you know, the large companies go into a small farming community, and they say, okay, you have, you know, 10,000 pounds of coffee.
Yeah.
We're going to pay you market value $1.20 a pound. Well, that coffee is actually worth, in the States, $3.50 a pound. So they're making that $2 a pound.
Jeez.
Which is crazy because at the end of the day, just the investor gets the money.
Yeah.
But that guy that sold his 10,000 pounds for $1.20 has 12 grand now. But he could have 36.
Yeah.
So it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I mean,
it ain't
this
right.
guy, that's all he has.
It ain't right.
That's all he has.
Yeah.
$1,000 a month. He lived on $1,000. You can't do it here. There you can, but you know how much it took to get that $1,000 a month? It probably cost $6,000 to $8,000 to grow that crop. So, like, he's got $4,000 to live on in a year?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
It's not sustainable.
I get that.
So we're trying to give back to those communities, and we're trying to help those people out. You know, I mean, it's all about doing good in the world. If you do good to others, good will be done to you.
I agree.
And, you know, yeah, we could probably build this company like Blue Bottle that sold to Nestle for $800 million. I mean, yeah, but what went back to the community? Nothing's going back to the community. So, like, I'd rather make a less profit and doing good in the world and
and ruin communities.
You know what's great about coffee too is like, you know, you're in the oil field, oh, you're a dirty fracker, right? With coffee, it's like, you do coffee? I love coffee. We're friends already.
Oh yeah.
So it's a good icebreaker, right?
No, I mean, and that's the thing too. So I mean, you're getting into this, you're following your passion, you're developing this brand. I mean, so how's that going for you? So your hard hat's hung up for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're full blown into this. And so I guess, how's that been, during the middle of a pandemic, not only to open up your own business, which is a coffee business, but also to kind of distribute that, to market that, to even sell it in this type of market, because it's such an off year. So this can't really reflect on how business will be moving forward. So, I mean, what's been some of the challenges and successes that you've seen and looking back on it, would you have done this sooner?
definitely stressful. It's a lot of investment. It's a lot of work that goes into this. I mean, we're working. When you work for yourself, you work every day. There's never a day off.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, it's just getting in front of people. We're trying to sell to coffee shops and grocery stores. So we've been working on trying to get on the shelves, different grocery stores. We just signed a deal with Shinerville Coffee House.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw that on y'all's Facebook page.
So, you know, little by little, we're getting into different coffee shops. And okay. We're about to get into a place in Midland. We're about to get into a place in Dallas. We're about cool. to get into a place in Austin. So, like, we're adding different aspects to it. So it
And you're seeing some successes pop up, too.
I've never been a salesman, but I have a lot of buddies of mine that are oil field salesmen. I mean, you know, when I was in the oil field, I considered, you know, if I bought something from you, we had a connection. And, you know, I wouldn't beat you up or anything. We'd make sure it was all mutual, beneficial for both. Yeah. And we'd hang out together, right? I mean,
that's how it should be,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Sometimes it's not.
Yep.
But, you know, I learned how the salesman sold to me. And I was always on this side of it. So whenever you go to the other side, you know what the guy you're selling to wants because you've been there.
Yeah.
So it's a little easier. It's fun. You go in there.
You're able to sit on both sides of the table.
Yeah. So I used to, you know, make sales calls to coffee shops. I'd have my khakis on, a button-up shirt and stuff. And then you go in there and, you know, it's like, you know, I wouldn't say hippie, but, you know.
No, I get it. It's more, it's more.
They're like back.
Streetwear. Yeah.
They're like. Yeah. What the hell is this guy?
Who's a square coming in?
Yeah, they're like, I'm not buying coffee.
Yeah.
So now I'm just like, look, I'm one of y'all, you know, I'm a coffee farmer, right? So it's a different aspect of it, different viewpoint. But yeah, that's kind of our vision and goal, right? And we have a little write-up about the journey and the farm on the bag as well, and it kind of explains what we're all about. But we only buy 85 and above coffee. And all these farms, the Tanzania is 86.
So how does that work? So you own your own farm, and you keep saying you're meeting with all these. You know, so you're buying other beans,
yes,
from local farms that are adjacent or neighbors or in the community.
No, this is from Colombia and Tanzania and Guatemala. Okay. So we got in contact with other farmers because. You know, with coffee, if you only offer one origin.
Oh, that's how you can mix them. Okay, yeah, okay.
It kind of corners you up.
So it's kind of like partnerships.
Yeah. So we partner up with these farms and like, look, we have this much a year, you have this much a year. We can either trade that or we can buy it or sell it, et cetera, right? We help each other out and thrive on one another.
So how difficult is it, I guess, to get that palate to taste actual, like, the differences in coffee? I mean, do you know, are you there yet? Where are you at?
I'm not there. It's called a Q grader.
Okay.
And you can go to school for this, but it's like a wine taster, but actually way more in depth. I mean, in Bolivia, I think there's only two Q graders in the whole country. The States has the most, but it's a very niche market. There's so little these people
that are the experts in this. I remember when I was over in France, they have someone called like the nose, and they'll go into perfumeries and they are the experts in their field, you know, and they go in and I think they only like sniff like seven things, like seven scents a day, and like that's it for like 3 weeks or something like that. Look, I don't know, don't quote me on that, but it's some bullshit like that where it's like a cake, you know. It's like, but they go through all this training, and they're very well revered in that industry.
Yeah.
So you're not there yet.
No. Well, you can't get there right now because there's no in person courses right now. It has to be taught in person.
So the whole roasting process and that entire process. I mean, you kind of learned that, I guess, when you bought in on this farm.
Yeah, we just go there and we had a master roaster that was like helping out the farm when I first you know, went down there and met the farm, right? So, you know, this guy's kind of saying we need to roast it like this. We need to bring it. There's two cracks in coffee, so you get green coffee, right?
Okay,
you load it in the roaster.
Okay.
And the roaster, it has a hopper up top.
Yep.
Which you put the roaster, you know, put the beans in. And then it has a drum that's perforated that rotates.
Yep.
So it's rotating and there's a flame below it.
Yep.
So you're just kind of heating that coffee up, right? So it's kind of like watching a frack job almost, you know, like it's graphs, right? So you want to get a declining rate of rise, which
transferable skills, everyone out there. Go on. Yeah.
So when you load the beans in there, we usually charge like 410 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
So we put the beans in there, but the beans are 75 degrees or 70 degrees, the temperature of the room. So, of course, you're going to have a drop in temperature, and then you have a turning point.
Right.
And the turning point, the time to the turning point is not critical, but the turning point time from that point on is where you're roasting the beans.
Okay.
So usually 410, we have a 12-kilo roaster, 26 pounds. We usually load it at 10 kilos, which is 22 pounds.
Okay.
get in there, the turning point will go all the way down to about 205, 201, and then it'll start turning around. And now you're actually roasting the coffee and cooking it. And you're going to go through different sensory milestones when you're roasting the coffee. So you're going to have a sensory milestone called the yellow phase, or the like you'll smell like fresh cut grass.
Okay.
And that's usually like 275 degrees. And then you're going to smell hay, which is like 305, 310. And then baking bread is about 325, 330. So you have a dryer.
It goes through all those senses, those smell. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like I said, green coffee has 50 sensory milestones, and it has 250 plus sensory milestones roasted. So once you're going through this process, you're kind of heating the coffee up, and you're kind of the Maillard process and the drying process and the caramelization process, right? So when you get to about 350, that's whenever the coffee is edible.
Okay.
That's when you can actually brew it, and it's actually, you know, it can be consumed. 350 and above. But 350 is like a very, very light roast. It's probably going to look like tea. And then you get to about 380. Some people pull off there. It's like a light cinnamon roast.
Okay.
Or a blonde roast, they call it. And then you get to like 390, 400. You're getting a little bit, you know, medium roast. When we get to, we usually pull off about 420, 425. And that's like a medium roast, just what, you know, what you saw earlier when you run, when we put the beans in.
Yeah.
And then you're going to go into like first crack usually happens like 380. Sorry. So first crack is whenever you're cooking all of the moisture off the bean and it pops like popcorn.
Okay.
So all the moisture
is
going
out.
Yeah, you can hear it. Cool. And you actually, on the software, because it's all done on a computer now, we can control the flame height and everything. And we're kind of graphing this as it goes.
Cool.
Right? Because whenever you're increasing the temperature, the rate of rise or the slope of the increase in temperature should be decreasing the whole time. So you start at like 30 degrees a minute.
Yeah.
And it'll go to 25, 20, 15, 10, and then you're pretty much done.
Okay.
But you always want a straight line there. So it's like always perfecting that and like, what do we do different on this roast? Could we maybe increase the temperature a little earlier, a little later? And it's just kind of trial and error, right?
And it that's got to be kind of fun, though. I mean,
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, that's product development at the ground level.
Yeah, at some point we're going to get a recipe, and it'll just be plug and play, and I'll get bored. I guess
you're not there yet. You're not there yet. Yeah. Until then, you got to have fun doing it.
So it's all manual now.
Yeah.
So you have the first crack, and then you have the second crack, and the second crack is when you're driving everything out of the bean, and you're actually going into the oil phase of the bean. You're actually pulling oil out of the beans.
So what does that bring you? Is that the dark roast at the espresso?
Dark roast,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, they say espresso, so that's kind of a myth out there. Espresso it doesn't have to be dark. It could be a medium. I mean, people say espresso roast is dark.
Okay.
But that's just kind of what Starbucks teaches you, right? Because they only roast dark.
Don't even start on Charbucks.
Yeah, but I mean, you can do a medium roast. Like with this, people use this for their espressos.
And I've actually read that the darker the roast, the less caffeine.
Yep.
Is that?
There you go.
And a lot of people believe that it's give me a dark roast. It's actually less caffeine.
Well, because it's all about volume. So
you're telling me that like I understand. What do you mean? Like
the darker the roast is less dense.
Okay.
Because you're cooking more of the bean.
Everything
off.
Out. Okay.
So by weight, all coffee has the same amount of caffeine. But by volume, darker roast has less caffeine than light roast.
Okay.
So.
Well, I'm looking at your package right now. I'm seeing – so these packages are really – I mean, it's a cool-looking package, first off, everyone out there. I highly recommend everyone checking out their website, cuevascoffee.com, and you can find them on Instagram and Facebook, and it seems like, you know, they put it together. But it's kind of cool. So I'm looking at these. You got the Colombia, you got Tanzania, you got Guatemala right there, and you have Colombia right there. So you're showing where they're sourced from.
Yes.
I like
that. And then we have the roast date on there too.
Yeah, I see that, 12.
So – yeah. If you're a coffee buyer, I mean, I'm not telling you must go buy my coffee or anything like that, but if you're buying coffee, make sure it has a roast date on there and not an expiration date.
Or if you are a coffee drinker, I mean, if you are listening to this and you know JD, or you're curious about this process and kind of what he's done, buy one, see what you think.
Yeah.
And then go from there.
Yeah.
And then see what you think. So go on. So it cracks and so.
Yeah, so we usually take off before the second crack.
Okay.
The second crack is usually like 425.
Okay.
But we have a dark roast because we offer dark roast to people because they like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to offer everything. And then people, when they see different flavors of coffee, you know, flavored coffee has added flavor to it, right? So like Texas pecan or whatever.
Yeah.
It's artificial flavoring.
Right.
So probably not too healthy for you to drink that. So we roast coffee to bring out the natural flavors in this.
It's really good.
Yeah. So the Tanzania has like that, you know, the deep tones of, you know, fruits and kind of, you know, the earthy, you know, milestones.
Yeah.
And then the Guatemala has a bright acidity at the beginning, which is one of my favorite. I can't choose a favorite, but I've been drinking that a lot lately.
Okay.
It's got like kind of like a citrus acidity at the beginning and then a smooth finish. They're all smooth. Just like it says, you know, the way coffee
smells
supposed
to be. So damn good, dude. It really does. And you got little K-cups too.
Yeah, so we got the K-cups. We have Angel's Brew and Devil's Brew.
Oh.
So the Angel's Brew is the light roast. Yeah. All it is the Tanzanian coffee in the K-cup form. And then the dark roast, the Devil's Brew, is just pretty much the darker roast.
The less caffeine one.
Yeah, so when we're done with that, we drop into a cooling tray.
Okay.
And the cooling tray has kind of a mixer in there.
Okay.
And it has a suction fan at the bottom. And you should cool that coffee off within 3 minutes of dropping into that tray. And then we put it into a destoner, which takes all the heavy particles out of the coffee if there's anything in there.
Okay.
It's just a, you know, QAQC process so you don't mess a grinder up down the road.
Right.
And people have actually posted, we're on some forums on Facebook for coffee roasters. I've seen some like nuts and bolts and stuff in there, the coffee.
No shit.
Yeah, we try to work with farmers that don't put that in there, but every now and then something drops in there, right? We've never found anything yet to date.
Right.
So dump it in that, and then we bag it and seal it and send it out to you.
So what's going to change once, I guess, the travel restrictions get lifted and kind of things start moving again for you? I guess what's going to change for you? Be more located down there? You're going to be up here pushing it? You're going to be trying the recipes out? I mean, perfecting it, which is pretty damn good right now. So
yeah. So right now we started off with three different origins plus ours.
Okay.
Right now with COVID and stuff, we're working on the exportation for ours. We have a container lined up and everything, but FDA is extremely limited right now, so it's just getting their approval.
Yeah.
Hopefully by the end of this month, it'll be shipped. So hopefully in January, fingers crossed, that it'll be in the U.S.
Okay.
And then probably every month or two after that, we'll add a different coffee farm. We'll add a different variety.
Oh.
And then we'll kind of have, you know, we're looking at Costa Rica, Panama, Honduras right now, and then probably Ethiopia and Kenya as their big coffee producers. Would love to get some
JD,
stuff from Hawaii.
JD, this sounds so unbelievably just a cool I'm fascinated by it. I think the whole process, I love coffee. And I just think your story is so cool. The fact that, you know, you get all this experience, you bust your ass working, you proved yourself, you know, since you were in high school. And right now you're branching off. And just as we talked about, you know, do something you love, find your passion, do that. And you're literally doing that. And that's kind of why I think it's great that you're coming on, not only to talk about Cuevas Coffee and talk about you know one of our oil field family friends out there, but also kind of pursuing your passion. What advice would you give out there for people that are kind of sitting in a situation and kind of on the fence about jumping and pursuing a passion or not? Like, what advice would you give, and practical advice?
Yeah, I mean,
out there
right now in the pandemic and everything, people are stuck at home.
Yeah.
Don't get stuck in that rut where you're just at home doing nothing. Do something good for the world. Do something good that you love. Pursue your passion, right?
Right.
People like, you know, collecting guns or reloading, you know, ammo or woodworking. I know a few people on the show have said woodworking or different things. Just kind of follow your passion. Maybe you want to open a snow cone stand. Maybe you want to open a, you know, homemade ice cream shop.
Yeah.
You know, make gelato with Cuevas Coffee Roasters.
But you know what's cool about that? I mean, a lot of people are they might be sitting there thinking, well, I don't know shit about that. I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything about this. I only know rigs. You know, that's all. But you kind of didn't know either. I mean, you were kind of a novice at this. You don't know the process. You didn't know the from the birth to dirt or the ground, the tree to the cup, whatever.
Yeah, plant to cup.
Plant to cup. So you were very, but you didn't sit around.
No.
You hopped on it and you learned yourself up to the point where you took, 120 hours, something like that online.
Mm-hmm.
You got in, you learned the process from the ground, literally the ground up. And I think that, you know, so if you, whether you do have a passion, I'm not telling people what to do, but whether you do have a passion or something or not, and if you really don't know about it, teach yourself.
Yeah.
You got a time right now.
Well, knowledge is free, right? I mean, we live in a world where you have tons of videos on YouTube, tons of information on the internet. You have online courses now. You have Zoom, you know, online trainings and stuff. Just find something you love.
Even what you were talking about, surround yourself with, you know, nine people smarter than you in that aspect and just kind of learn from them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, man, do you have anything else that I didn't bring up regarding this?
I think we covered most.
So okay, let's do a little plug. Where can you find Aquila's Coffee Roasters right now?
So we're all online
okay.
now.
Okay.
We're working with a few people. Like I said, we have Shinerville Coffee House that you can buy it in Shiner.
Yep.
We're working with a few people in Dallas and in Midland. So it'll be on the shelf soon.
Well, hopefully by the time this release, which I'm thinking maybe in January, beginning of February, you'll be seeing this more.
Yes.
And again, everyone, it's Cuevas Coffee Roasters, Cuevas Coffee Roasters, and it's a cool looking bag, and it smells good, and it's very good. Check them out on follow them on LinkedIn. Not LinkedIn, I'm sorry, Facebook and Instagram, and just reach out to JD if you want to shoot the shit with him or talk coffee or oil field, whiskey, golf, yeah. or whatever. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, play a lot of golf, yeah.
has your game improved at all?
Man, I haven't had much time to play with all this going on, to be honest
with
you.
But this seems like such a cool thing to get into, you know what I mean? I think wine, like coffee, like this whole, these worlds, you know, these cultures are just, it's a cool draw for me. I don't know why, because I think it's not just a cup of coffee. There's more to it. You know, there's a different palate taste levels. I think it's cool.
So. Yeah, I didn't know this back when we started the business, you know, or the brand in June, but the biggest industries right now that are growing is insurance and coffee.
Really?
I didn't know that. Somebody just told me the other day.
I didn't know that either. Well, man, I appreciate you coming in, man. I really enjoyed this. And again, everyone, if you're listening to this, I mean, you can always pull this up on YouTube to check out the coffee bag and what it looks like. But again, you can find them on. I mean, I love this, dude. I'm happy for you. I'm happy that you pursued your passion. You're making something from it. So
good.
Thanks for the coffee, man. I appreciate it. And thanks for the coffee mug. And again, you can find them on Instagram and Facebook, Cuevas Coffee Roasters. And
yeah, if you have any questions, we have an email info@cuevascoffee.com, and we check that daily, and send us a note. Send us, you know, if you're thinking about something or want some advice or what to buy, we're available for that.
Yeah.
And we can kind of, you know, show you what exactly each coffee does and, you know, what flavors it has.
I think it's delicious.
We'll have some blog posts coming soon to the website.
Check out the blogs, and we'll post that once we release this episode. And man, I appreciate it. I really did. Thanks for the coffee, and I enjoyed this talk.
Yeah, thanks.
I really did. All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.